If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Hey, Tommy, we got a lot to talk about this week because there's a lot going on. First and foremost, we got two new sports cars, the new 2027 Nissan Z gets the most significant changes in years. There's a new Corvette in town. We did a really interesting video where we went and compared a hybrid to an EV. We've got two new Jeeps in the stable. We're going to Easter Jeep Safari, and I've got some myths I want to bust.
And we bought a Volkswagen van.
Yeah, we'll talk about that, which is cooler than you think it is. And what's this thing you got in your hand there?
This is related to the Volkswagen van. It is the most complicated light switch on the planet that does one thing. So we'll talk about that later in our Volkswagen segment.
Yeah, for those of you who are listening, Tommy's holding up a Volkswagen light switch from, I don't know what car that is, but he's got
Mark IV Golf, but that's not the most interesting thing. As much as you want to hear about a light switch from an 02 Volkswagen.
So let me bust three myths, okay?
Yes.
These have been bugging me. I've been listening to a lot of podcasts, and I keep hearing these myths get like recirculated and regurgitated, and I'm really tired of them. So I'm going to do my best to like bust the myth because they are misinformative and they are wrong. The first one, and the one that just gets – I just heard it repeated again, and that is when a car manufacturer comes out with a new car, the myth is – the false myth is that there's a law that states that they have to have parts for it for 10 years.
Yeah, I was just talking to an OEM about this, and they said there's actually no such law that exists. But if, for example, they offer a 10-year battery warranty or an 8 or a 10-year emissions warranty, they are legally required to supply parts to support that warranty up through the warranty period.
Yeah, but there's no rule that says for the next 10 years, every part in the car has to be available for you to purchase. I actually talked to not one, but two purchasing managers at OEMs, and I asked them about this, and they said the way it works is when they come up with a new car, pick a new car, give me a new car.
Corvette.
All right, when the new Corvette comes out, they get together with their suppliers, and because they want to get the best deal possible for the parts they need to build it, and eventually for the parts that they will need to replace it, they try to order as many parts as possible without necessarily, you know, getting stuck holding on to a lot of parts. So the more parts they order, the better deal they get per part.
Right.
So there's this like dance that happens between the purchasing manager and the supplier to the OEM. Let's say it's Bosch or whoever makes these parts. And so they have a formula for that, but there's no rule that states that 10 years from now, that part has to be available. And in fact, it's better than that because what ends up happening is they usually don't have parts for 10 years, but cars get crashed, then they get recycled, and a lot of those parts 5 years from now or 7 years from now come from the cars that have been taken out of service or have been crashed or are no longer around. But please stop repeating this BS lie that seems to make people happy, because what ends up happening is the way that this gets spread around is a new car gets introduced and people are really worried about it, because obviously we're all going to keep our cars for the next 50 years. And so they get really worried about the fact that 10 years from now, they won't be able to get parts. And the fact is, you may not be able to get parts 5 years from now. And so that is one of the myths that I am happily to bust.
There you go.
You good with that?
Sure. What's next?
Well, let's spread these throughout the podcast.
Okay.
I don't want to do them all at once, and I'll tell you the next one after we talk about the sports car news. So let's talk about the new 2027 Nissan Z Nismo.
Yeah, so the big news for the Nissan Z Nismo is it finally gets the manual transmission. So when this car launched a little while back alongside the standard Z, it was automatic only, which was definitely a little bit of a miss, because this is the most enthusiast-minded version of the Z, the performance version. But now it's finally getting the 6-speed manual from the standard car. So this is great. It's got a short shift lever and upgraded clutch versus the other Z models. Other mechanical differences, revised steering rack, brakes from the GTR, which is pretty cool. So it's a 2-piece rotor, 19 pounds lighter at the front, and then retuned suspension. Still more horsepower than the standard Z, so 420 horsepower versus a normal Z sitting at right at 400, and also more torque, 34 pound-feet more torque. But we also have different styling.
Yeah, I think they freshened up the styling on the Nismo, made it a little nicer looking. So I drove the newest version of the Z when it first came out a few years ago, and it was really a story of the best of times and the worst of times. I'll start with the worst. The problem was that because Nissan didn't put 100% of their effort into it, it's the 350Z, shares a lot of the chassis, shares a lot of the switch gears.
370,
shares, and actually from the 352.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So I misspoke, but actually I misspoke correctly.
Yeah.
So they didn't exactly do a complete, ground up refresh. But they did change the styling of the vehicle, but a lot of the switchgear came from the old car, and they actually had all the generations of the Z at the launch, and so I was able to do a video showing all the different generations, and so you could pretty easily tell that the interior bits were the same.
Yeah.
From 350 to 370 to the current one. And for some reason, it didn't sell.
Well, I think it's not necessarily the fault of the car. I just think
I like the car a lot. I love the design, but it didn't sell.
It's a reality of the market. Sports cars do not sell in big volumes in 2026. It's the same reason that the Supra ultimately died, right? I think both the Z and the Supra were arguably the best of their generations, although I know some people would disagree with that. But in terms of performance, in terms of handling, the new Z and the new Supra are better than they've ever been, out of the box at least. And just the market, people say they want these cars, and then when it comes to actually buying them, very few of them actually end up being sold.
So I think the problem is two different stories, same problem, and same outcome. So with the Supra, which you bring up, which is very relevant, the issue when it first came out and went on launch of that as well was everybody was whining about the fact or complaining about the fact that this wasn't a real Supra because it was jointly built with BMW. Mm-hmm. So, one of the videos we did was you went under the hood and you could see all the BMW powertrain, you could see all the BMW parts. But as it turned out over time, people realized that the partnership was actually very smart because the engine that's in the Supra is one of BMW's best. And so now you have a situation where when people finally came around, and everybody has, I get it. Some people still in the comments will be like, "No, it's a hybrid monstrosity," not hybrid in terms of powertrain, but hybrid in terms of half BMW, half Toyota. But people are coming to the realization that it's actually a good partnership, and you've got a really good powertrain combined with really interesting styling in the part of Toyota. And now that it's leaving, people are starting to kind of regret the fact that it's leaving.
Yeah.
And I think the same thing's going to happen with the Z.
The problem is, though, the hardcore Toyota purists have never fully accepted the Supra. Like your friend James, right?
Yeah.
James, who's all about Toyota. He's got an LC. He drives pretty much only Toyotas. He never
and
came.
A Bolt.
Yeah, and a Bolt for some reason. But he never came around to the Supra, right? He said it's a BMW underneath. It'll always be a BMW underneath.
Yeah, but he bought the fourth Mark IV Supra.
Yep.
And he also sold that.
Yeah, he didn't like it very much. But I think that the reality is
it was automatic.
It's a great car, the current Supra, and I think that the non-hardcore Toyota fans are all about it, right? Especially people that are just into cars in general, not necessarily brand specific. I think a lot of folks see the value in having that BMW partnership, but the real core of the Toyota enthusiasts never fully accepted it as a Supra. And I think that that's not necessarily the case with the Z, because everything in the Z is Z, right? It's all Nissan. So it doesn't really have that excuse. I actually don't think the pricing is all that bad either. It starts at the 2027. We don't know, but the 26 starts at about 44. And that's a lot of car. I mean, 400 horsepower, 350 pound-feet of torque for $44,000 is pretty good.
Yeah, the current Nismo is 67, so I figure
that's less good. But the normal Z, I'm saying.
But a Supra is going to be 72 if you get the.
Sure. Yeah.
It's going to. So look, there are a couple cars that I regret not buying. The final edition of the last Mitsubishi Evo 10. I wish I had bought that, or I wish if I had been smart, we would have bought it because it's worth more. Same thing with the Heritage edition of the Land Cruiser, the 200 series. And I think these are two cars that if you are thinking about having a car that may not necessarily depreciate but will appreciate, now don't hold me to this because we don't give financial advice, but if I were at my dithers and we didn't have to create content all the time and I just wanted a car to hold on, it would either be this manual Nismo or the manual Supra. And it's funny because everybody is complaining, and we'll get to people complaining about the Corvette, that it's not available in a manual. And then you have these two sports cars that are in manuals, and yet they're both dying a slow death because people aren't buying them.
True. I think
so. Why is there that discrepancy? Why is everybody's like, oh, Porsche only makes, you know, two manuals now in the 911, and yet here you have two very good manuals, and people are like, oh no, I can't.
I think part of it, frankly, is that a lot of car enthusiasts probably can't afford a $67,000 Nismo Supra, right?
So you're saying the youngsters want the manuals.
But yeah, people like my age want manuals, but we also can't afford the new manuals. All right. Then we go out and buy the old manuals.
I get that, but I was at Pebble Beach last year.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of people your age running around in GT3 RSs.
Well, what's a lot? 100?
I don't know how.
It's relative.
Right? But apparently, you can't afford a $67,000 Nismo, but you can't afford a $350,000. That's the price. That's the price before the markup of a GT3 RS 911.
I mean, the problem is we're living in this K-shaped economy, right? Where you've got the haves, the have-nots, but the problem is now we have the have-lots. So there's a lot of people that can't afford a $10,000 car, and then there's really not a lot of people in the middle that can afford a $67,000 car, and then there's a shocking number of people that can afford a $300,000 car. So we are in this weird situation where we've got a ton of people way at the top of the market and then a ton of people who can't afford anything. And then these cars are appealing to a shrinking demographic of folks that can't afford a $67,000 toy. So it's a very, very weird time right now to be anybody, but even especially a car enthusiast, I think.
I would say that because of this K-shaped economy, what we have and what we didn't have in the past. So GT products in the past out of the 911 range, right, did not sell. For the most part, because these were race cars for the road, and most enthusiasts in America, I'm not saying in Europe, a lot of people take their sports cars to the track, but in America, most enthusiasts did not track their cars. Mm-hmm. And then what ended up happening, I think, was you had the onset of Cars and Coffee, where you wanted to show off your car, and now even if you didn't track your car, you could get that GT product or the GT3 product, or the RS, and take it and show it off somewhere. So that's the first thing that happened.
Yep.
And then the second thing that happened was those cars started to become popular and they started to appreciate There was no longer that depreciation curve where you bought it, it just fell off a cliff, and then over the next 30 years it came back up. It just went straight up. And so a lot of let's say, non-car enthusiast people got involved as a way to basically hedge against inflation or make money.
Yep.
And so all of a sudden, all those cars became not for us, but they became for people who just wanted a lot of ways to diversify their revenue stream and make money on them. And then the thing just took off like crazy.
Well,
and the problem with that is that at 67,000, let's say it's 70,000, the Nismo is never going to have that straight up curve.
I mean, I think it depends. Part of it too is limited supply, right? And a lot of demand. So the reason I think that the Z manual, especially in the final edition, is going to be a fairly good investment, or at least a lack of depreciation, is because it's a limited number of vehicles and production is coming to an end, right? So I think that you could park your money in a final edition Supra manual and probably not keep up with inflation or the stock market, but you wouldn't lose a ton of money.
Right, if it were your money, which would you get? The Z's not done yet, but you can see the writing on the wall.
No, but the problem is that because this is not a limited edition and because it's not officially done yet, I think this is a depreciating asset in the Z. Right. And if you look at...
Maybe Nissan should have made a limited edition.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. If you look at current Z prices, I mean, they're on their way down.
Right? All right. So you're saying you'd buy the Supra. Given dollar for dollar them being about the same, well, you'd buy the Supra.
I mean, if I wanted to not lose money, but I actually think I like the way the Supra drives more. I think that it's a better investment. But for me, I actually love the way the Z looks so much. I'll probably get the Z.
I really like that Z car too. Not that I don't like the Supra. I just don't fit in it.
Well, that's also the big problem. It is a limited cabin space for...
The headroom is just not there for somebody over 6 feet tall.
For sure. That's a huge problem.
All right, let's jump to the next new sports car that was unveiled this week. And that is, of course, the Chevy ZLS-powered 6.7-liter Grand Sport.
Yep. So this is the C8 Grand Sport, right? Grand Sport came out actually technically in the 1960s. You know, there was a race version of the Corvette called the Grand Sport. But really, the Grand Sport as we know it in the modern era debuted in the C4 generation. One of Case's dream cars, by the way.
You know, I fell in love with the Grand Sport when we had it at the office in the C6.
Yep.
I just always loved that car. I love the four exhausts. I love the wider body, which is all, you know, very iconic in the Grand Sport. And so they introduced two new models, a 550 horsepower, 6.7-liter powered Grand Sport, naturally aspirated.
Uh-huh.
And then there is another one that's 721 horsepower, which is basically a replacement for the E-Ray.
Yeah, so they're putting the electric motor on the front axle and then the new LS6 in the rear. So this is a big deal for Corvette fans, right? Because this is a different engine than we've been accustomed to, right? So return to the LS nomenclature, 6.7 liter, naturally aspirated V8. Now, typically, historically, what the Grand Sport has been is a wide body Z06 car with a smaller / detuned engine out of the normal Stingray, right? This is a little bit different.
Yeah, because Z06, which we now own, we actually own three Corvettes. We own the first of the C3s. We own a 68.
Mm-hmm.
We own a ZR1 C4,
yep.
First of the ZR1s. And we own a Z06, which only has 670 horsepower. So actually the Grand Sport's going to have more horsepower.
In the X, specifically, not the standard
right.
one. Right.
I wonder where they'll price it.
Well, I mean, so first of all, they killed the E-Ray.
Yeah.
So as I read, the E-Ray
nobody
was...
Nobody liked the E-Ray.
Well, I mean, it was...
I just didn't sell very
well. Yeah, it was kind of a confusing car. But I think that this new plan to just add X, meaning it's got the front electric motor, is probably a good plan. The same thing with the ZR1, right? There's a ZR1 and the ZR1X. But I don't know where they're going to price this. I mean, I think it's going to be squat in between the Stingray and the Z06.
Right? It kind of feels like they're taking a page out of Porsche. I think there's 25 different variants on the 911.
For sure.
And now there's going to be, what is that, 4 or 5, if I do my math right, variants of the Corvette.
Yep.
Obviously, they just introduced the ZR1 and the ZR1X, which are 1,000 and 1,200 horsepower, respectively. And the question that I would ask you, Tommy, is out of all those, if you had your dithers, which one would you buy? Would you go for the crazy horsepower ZR1 or ZR1X, or would you get the more traditional 6.7 LS powered, or would you go for a base Corvette, which still starts at just under, I think, 70?
Yeah, I mean, I think my problem with it is that the performance envelope has gotten so high that to enjoy these cars at all means losing your license if you're on a public road.
If I were a McLaren or Porsche, I'd be worried.
Yeah, but this has always been the case with Corvettes, right?
No, I mean, Corvette has always had the reputation for being like old guy, right?
No, but like if you look
white shoes, white belt.
But they've always outperformed their European rivals.
They've always out-horsepowered.
But performed.
Until the C7, they really didn't outperform.
That's not true. I was just reading an article about the first ZR1, 1990, okay? Car and Driver did a comparison with a 1990 ZR1.
I saw that comparison.
And a 911 Turbo.
Yeah.
And in a roll race, the ZR1 was faster than a 911 Turbo.
All right, but they've always had, until the C7, really budget interiors.
Sure.
And so if you put one up against the other, the discerning connoisseur... sports car gal or guy would look at the interior of the thing and say, this is something out of a pick your generation of Corvette.
And they still do. This is the crazy thing, is I was just reading a review, a European review of a Corvette.
Yeah, the Europeans hate Corvette.
And they still, so I, even though it's the nicest
interior.
You
guys are snooty.
It's the nicest interior that Corvette's ever had. It's easily on par with a lot of the German brands or Italian brands. I just don't think it can shake that reputation. I really don't.
Well, I'm serious. If I were like sitting at...
Yeah, but they should have been afraid.
In Italy, running Maserati or Ferrari or McLaren in the UK or in Germany running Porsche, I would really start to be worried because...
I don't even think it's on the radar. And I don't think it should be. I mean, if you're a Porsche, right?
Yeah.
If you're that 21-year-old kid who wants a GT3 RS, that kid's not going to want a Grand Sport, right? Because
that's changing. It's like a super tanker. Changing a car's reputation takes a long time. But by putting the engine, making it mid-engined, by changing the styling to make it less old man-y, I mean, that's what we're talking about, right? It's been always an old man car. And by now introducing different variants so that people have this argument, so now you could sit down and over, you know.
But it's always been the argument. Like, you pull up to the country club, your friend's got a 911 Turbo, you've got a C601, my car's faster than your car, it's got more horsepower than your car,
it out-corners your car. I think, like, in the past, that argument didn't happen with Corvettes. You just pull up, and it wasn't like...
I think it's always happened.
You were like, hey, it's a Corvette, and most people thought old man in a new Corvette. Now I think because the car has become so... well endowed with track capability, and you've made it into a Ferrari competitor with the Z06 with the flat plane crank, right, where it now sounds just like a Ferrari.
Yep.
Or you can go the traditional route, you know, classic American, you know, now 6.7 LS, or you can go, you know, classic American horsepower through the roof, or you could take it to the drag strip and go drag racing. It's actually made it an enthusiast car because all of a sudden you've got all these different variants that you can talk about.
Listen.
Which in the past people, I guess Corvette guys did, but most people I think just had this...
I mean, ZR1, that made the magazine cover, right? ZR1 faster than 911 Turbo.
Yeah, but the last generation ZR1 had oodles of power but didn't have the chassis to control
it. I'm talking 1990.
Yeah, but right? That's C4. Too far back.
Same thing with C6. That ZR1 was faster than the Ferraris of the time. I just think...
But crappy interior
the problem
again.
That is, if you're a buyer for a prancing horse, you're not buying a Chevy.
I think it's changing.
I hope you're right, but I just don't see people are snooty like that, especially the people that can't afford these cars are snooty like that. And I think that this is the best Corvette that it's ever been with the most interesting generation. I mean, it's such an amazing car, but you still are fighting against the societal norms of saying, if I've got $200,000 or $400,000, I want the Porsche badge. I don't want a Chevy badge.
Yeah, you can have that conversation until, you know, the tire hits the pavement and you're at the track.
But it's always been like that.
No, it hasn't always been like that.
Since 1990, it's been like that.
You've only been around half as long as I have been around.
Yeah, but I've read the...
So you're like, I lived it, you read it. But which do you think is more important?
Dad, I read the magazine articles, right?
I don't want to bicker anymore.
And the ZR1s have always been
Once again,
faster.
We're bickering. Let's move on.
Okay. All Anyways, right. Would you buy whatever it's called, the what's the new car called? Grand Sport. Okay. Would you buy the new Grand Sport?
No, I love the Z06. I don't think the Z06 to me is still the most track-worthy, the most pure, the most... Z06 has always been that, but the most kind of pure, racy Corvette of them all. Because at some point, more than 600 or 700 horsepower is unusable on the street. And so it's cool to have that power, but, you know... It's like owning, I don't know, pick your favorite fast electric car, like a Plaid. You can only accelerate 2 or 3 times 0 to 60 in 2 seconds before it makes you sick. So, I mean, you have that ability, but it doesn't actually go anywhere. Maybe if you track your car, and I'm talking about the drag strip, not the regular track, then it might be worth doing. But I haven't driven one, so I don't know. Maybe if I get in one, I'll be like, holy crap, I want 1,000 horsepower or 1,200 horsepower. But for me, you know, there is a kind of a good and perfect middle point for that, and I think the Z06 is that.
Yeah, the only
also cost wise, it's affordable.
It's not $120,000.
It's affordable compared to $240,000.
Sure.
When we're talking about affordability in sports cars.
Yeah, I mean, I love the Z06 a lot, but it's a little too hardcore. That's why I would probably still just get the normal base car. I mean, the normal base car, Chevy says 0 to 60 in 2.9 seconds. How much faster do you need than 2.9 seconds, 0 to 60, right? I mean, that's so much performance.
The base car is incredible. We had one.
Yeah.
And it's like more of a touring car, whereas the Z06 is more of, and I haven't tested the other one, so I don't know, whereas the Z06 is more of a track car. It really depends on what experience you want. Do you want a daily driver? A Z06 is a pretty rough daily driver. I mean, you're going to scare everybody the second you start it up in any garage.
Right. I mean, and the problem is, like, in the real world, we're never going to the track.
Right.
You know?
No, we go to the track, but not because of, we just don't do track days as part of
our life.
Yeah. Part of our leisure life. We do a lot of track days.
Sure, but
it's
I'm
part
saying
of our job.
For fun, right?
Yeah, we don't do track days. So, I like off-roading better.
Yeah. So at that point, I'm like, well, if I'm not going to the track, why do I need the track car?
All right. I'm
going
to give you a really obscure myth that we busted, actually.
Okay.
This is super obscure. But I think if you're a true car guy or car gal, you appreciate this. So as you know, I'm Czech. And mm-hmm. So once upon a time, we bought a Tatra. Mm-hmm. A 603, and there's a rumor out there, and I actually did a lot of research into this, about the fact that during the Second World War, Mr. Hitler didn't allow his generals to drive Tatras. Now, back then, Tatras were the equivalent of like Bentleys today. They were very expensive. They were very fast. They were rear-engined, just like a Porsche, and the styling was out of this world, right? These were very aerodynamic cars. Mm-hmm. They had a giant kind of fin on the back. If you were, you know, a young German general and you had just invaded the Sudetenland,
yep.
And you wanted a Tatra, then you would get it because it was a cool car to drive. And the myth is that at some point, because of snap oversteer, because it was rear engine, just like a 911, what would happen is, and this is actually true, you'd be going around a corner and you'd take it too quickly and you'd let off the gas and then the back end would just come spinning around, which happened to us, by the way, in our Tatra getting on the Autobahn. If you weren't lucky, you'd be dead. And so the myth was that Adolf Hitler forbade his generals to drive Tatras because so many of them were dying because these things were so powerful and so hard to handle.
Yep.
So we decided when we bought our Tatra to go to the home of Tatra. What's the name of that town? I forgot.
Kopchanica.
Very good. Kopchanica. Let me say that the Czech way. And we went into the Tatra Museum and I had a long interview with the director of the Tatra Museum. Mm-hmm. You remember that?
Yeah, I do remember.
You shot it. Yeah, and one of the questions I asked him was about this. I was 100% sure that this sounded right because, of course, Hitler didn't want his generals to die. And he kind of looked at me when I said this and he said, wait, are we talking about the same Hitler? You think that Hitler gave a rat's ass about his generals? I mean, this is a guy who did a lot of worse things. And I started to think about it. I'm like, yeah, I don't think Hitler really would have cared. And so then he said, no, absolutely not. This is complete horse shit. Hitler didn't care. If you died, you died. That was just the way Hitler was. And so then I started doing some research. And it turns out that myth first was printed in some British car magazine back in the 60s. Ah. And ever since then, it's been repeated. It was recently repeated in Haggerty, where they actually rolled a Tatra. And they used that myth as a reason to actually, this was in the Lane Museum in Tennessee. They had a newer Tatra, but they wanted to see if they could actually roll it. And the reason for that entire story was because of this myth that Hitler forbade his generals driving Tatras, which is absolutely not true.
There you go. So I was thinking about this Grand Sport.
Yeah.
You know what would have made
the Grand Sport
this interesting?
Yeah.
This car should have had a manual.
Yeah. So what is it about car companies? We had a whole podcast about this. What is it about car companies not listening to their customers?
Because what we just talked about, where no one buys manuals. I mean, everyone says they want it, but no one buys them. But I do think that as an enthusiast, if I had this money,
so
which I don't.
Tremec, right?
Uh-huh.
Showed a manual Corvette at SEMA.
Yes. But then did you hear the engineering boss of Corvette said he wished that hadn't happened because it was never on the table and it's not possible.
I always think listening to your customers is a good idea.
But he was saying that the dual clutch that this car has is the superior option.
I could give you like three examples of when companies thought that they knew what was best for their customers.
Sure.
And in the long run, it ended up either really hurting their reputation. I mean, look at Dodge, right, with the latest Daytona.
I mean, I think a better example with manuals is companies like Volkswagen and BMW. So if you look at like the Volkswagen Type R or even the older BMW M5s, interesting thing about those cars is in many Europes, including the home market of Germany, those cars were only available with an automatic. specifically a dual clutch automatic or a single clutch automatic?
Yeah, so like GM looks at the take rate on the C7 manual.
Sure.
And they're like, hey, nobody was buying these things. So when the C8 came around, they were like, let's just take that off the table. But times change. Well, as times have changed quickly, people really want manuals because we're so sick of all the electronic crap that now are stuffed into modern cars that people are longing for just the simplicity of actually controlling the car themselves. And that longing is really being expressed, I think, especially more powerfully in the fact that people want manuals. And you're ignoring these people and you keep giving them vents that are electronically operated, door handles that slide into the door, crap that nobody wants. Because designers, for some reason, have decided that this is cool, and the public is clamoring for basic, simple, easy-to-operate cars, and yet they're all going in the exact opposite direction. So that's kind of the big picture.
Well, where I was going with my argument earlier was that Volkswagen and BMW both offered manuals here in the U.S., and now if you look at them historically, the E60 M5s with the manuals are worth 50 or 100% more than the automatics. The Golf R's are worth a lot more than the manual transmissions. And I think that as an engineer, you have to look at it from a technological standpoint like the Germans do. And the Germans would say the dual clutch is a superior technology. It offers faster response. The cars are quicker 0 to 60. But as a car enthusiast who may be buying that car, you want that engagement that the manual gives you. So I think it's a case, too, of you have to look at the mismatch between what the engineering brain says versus maybe what the enthusiast wants. Even though the manual is a far inferior product, it offers an experience that may be more in line with what you're selling.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think engineers have this way of looking at the world very logically, but people aren't logical. I'll give you a good example of that. When the Leaf first came out, the thing the engineers and then the marketing people said was the average American drives only 30 miles a day. Mm-hmm. So if we give them a car with 60 miles of range, that's plenty. But in real life, that's not how people think.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? They worry about like getting stuck. Some days they may want to stop and pick up their laundry or do something else. And all of a sudden that 30 miles becomes 40 miles. And then the car starts saying, oh, you only got 20% battery left. And it just killed the Leaf because it had nowhere near enough range. And I would argue that even most new electric cars, which have, 300 miles of range, are still, in a lot of people's minds, not enough because it takes a long time to refill. They don't know where they're going to refill it. You know, they're worried about being stranded by the side of the road. So what's logical in the engineer's brain does not work in the real world.
Yeah.
But even more basic than that, if you've got people clamoring, if you've got customers saying, we love Cool Ranch Doritos, and then, the company says, yeah, but, the Cool Ranch Dorito doesn't sell or hasn't sold, so we're not going to give it to them. I think that's always a bad business idea. I think just listen to your customers.
Yeah,
Give them what they want. BMW's down to one manual, right? The M2.
Yeah, that would be a good place to put money, too, I think, in the BMW manual. Speaking of good investments, potentially. But, I think that you're exactly on the money. I mean, the Corvette, the problem I have with the Corvette is it's kind of like the Porsche problem, where the product is becoming so stratified now, and there's so many slight variations on things, where, like, the Grand Sport, there's really not much of a reason to buy a Grand Sport over a standard car or a Z06, because the standard car's performance is so high, the Z06 performance is so high, and pricing-wise, where is that really going to fit in? But what would have made it really unique is if the Grand Sport did get a stick. That would have encouraged people to really go out and buy it, right? That would have been a big differentiator over the rest of the lineup, and I really would have loved to see that.
So let's do a little bit of consumer advocacy here. So if you guys love manuals and you're upset that you can't get a manual, think outside of the box. There are still vehicles that if you love shifting your own gears that you can get new with actually pretty good manuals. Let's start with off-roaders. You can get a Bronco and you can get a Wrangler with an off-roader. So if you really love the sense of shifting your own gears, and if you can't get a sports car because it's too expensive or because they no longer make them, think about a Wrangler or a Bronco. Both of those are really cool cars, really engaging cars, really fun to drive. They'll scratch that itch for you for the manual. And best of all, they're great in inclement weather. They're great, off-road. And as a daily, they're fun to drive and probably, very entertaining in a lot of other ways.
I think if you want sports cars, of course, you've got like the Miata, right? It's a really good option.
Yeah, the Miata, it's just such a, the problem with the Miata is people say Miata's the answer, but everybody's had one. It's just become a cliche of itself at this point. I'm kind of bored of the Miata. It's not that interesting anymore. It needs like something new.
CT5V Blackwing, right? That's too a really expensive. Interesting car. Yeah. I mean, if you're in Corvette money, it's not that expensive for a Corvette buyer. That's a crazy manual with the supercharged V8.
Yeah.
M2, M3, I think you can still get with a manual.
Only M2.
M3 base car, only not the competition.
Only M2 is the only BMW left with the
Are
manual.
Are you sure?
I promise you. Cole, you want to Google?
Yeah.
Get AI?
What's I'm asking. I'm asking the AI. Right. I'm on it.
All right. Or I'll give you some others. Come to the dark side. Come to truck world.
You got one truck.
You can get a Tacoma with a manual.
That's it.
There's no other manual?
Nope. That's it.
Well, then get yourself a Tacoma with a manual because it's a lot of fun to drive.
Can still get an M3 with a manual in the base car. 473 horsepower rear-wheel drive.
Really?
Yeah. The competitions you can't get the manual in. So if you want all-wheel drive, you got to get the 8-speed automatic. Not a lot of trucks anymore with manuals either. Specifically one truck.
No.
But it's not very good. I mean, you got I don't like that 2.4 liter. I don't think I'd really want it.
But the manual's very good.
I don't know. I've never driven it.
The
problem fundamentally too is the other issue with manuals is they have to interact with the engine correctly, right? And like so.
I think an automatic has to interact with the engine.
No, I mean,
the manual you can kind of control yourself.
Yeah, but not really, because like I was driving a Civic Si with the manual.
That's another one, by the way.
Yeah, and it wasn't very good because the rev hang was so bad. You'd shift gears.
Yeah, it's got that rev hang. How about the Type R?
That's better. But I'm saying like.
How about a WRX?
Can I finish my thought? What I'm saying is like when you're interacting with the engine, you want to make sure the engine you're interacting with behaves in a way that's fun to drive, right? And if it's rev hanging all the time, at that point, I'm like, just get the automatic. Right. If it's frustrating to drive,
I think that's a very small issue. That's an issue specific to the SI, the rev hang. I think most manuals don't do that.
I think like a lot of the new ones do because of emissions. I saw a piece about it. So
I've seen that happen more with like the old the problem like with the old 4Runner was that the manual and actually the problem with the old Tacoma was that the automatic. And that V6 didn't get along.
Exactly.
That was a really
And that
bad
can
match.
Also be a problem. But yeah. I'm saying it also can happen with so like if I'm getting a Tacoma, the other thing you have to keep in mind is so you get a manual Tacoma, which is cool. But then you're dealing with this engine, which is kind of the 2.4 liter turbo.
You had a manual Wrangler.
Yeah, I hated it. So I sold it.
Why did you hate it?
Because the manual wasn't good. Like it was smudgy. I thought that the shifts didn't feel very good. And ultimately it was geared wrong, so I could never use sixth gear. So that's a case where, like, you kind of should just get the automatic. Like, I bought that manual thinking I'm going to really have a better experience with it. But that Pentastar with that gearing just meant that it was never really that responsive.
So I'm going to say something that's controversial, but I think manuals suck off-road. I think you really burn the clutch on them.
For sure. That's another thing to consider.
I think automatics are much better off-road. Yeah.
So I probably wouldn't get maybe a Rubicon because you get the 410s, but I wouldn't get another base Wrangler with the manual.
Yeah, but the Bronco with that little granny gear manual is pretty
good. Yeah, really cool. But like you said, there's other manuals. There's the Integra, right? There's the Type S, right? You
get a manual. I just think a lot of it is people want what they can't have.
Sure. Oh, for sure.
This is always the issue. And so now you can get this Nismo with the manual, and people are going to be like, nah. And then 5 years from now, these things are going to be very valuable.
Yeah, potentially.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, let's keep going. Let's move on to our next topic, which is the thing you're holding in your hand. So we just bought yesterday a new vehicle to the TFL fleet because we're doing a new series called Flip It, where we're actually going to do a competition to see who can make more money flipping cars. We don't like flipping cars because I don't want to be in that world. We're not dealers. But for this series, we're going to put that on hold, and we are going to try to flip two cars. And the car that we bought, Tommy, you want to tell them what we bought?
Yeah, it's a 2003 Volkswagen Eurovan.
Yeah.
Which is very cool.
Why is it cool?
It's a weekender trim, so it's kind of got the camper thing going, which is cool. It's got the pop top and the rear seat that converts to a bed and the little fridge. But very interesting cars. I didn't realize how valuable these cars are. Like, they can sell $15,000, $20,000, even $25,000 for a really, really nice one, which is a lot of money for a 25-year-old Volkswagen.
What's the last camper that Volkswagen imported? Period.
Yes. Yeah. And
they kept developing them in Europe. Andre and Nathan drove to California.
Do you think that there will be a ID Buzz weekender?
Because for some reason, Volkswagen doesn't bring in the cool stuff anymore.
I think there might be. I've got my fingers crossed.
I wish Volkswagen, this is Wolfsburg, if you're listening, because this is where the decisions are made with Volkswagen. You gotta like bring in the cool stuff. And if you had brought in that California when COVID was happening, you would have, and I know they thought it was too expensive because, so the California, let me take a step back, is an all-wheel drive car.
It's not even on their press site, the Eurovan.
You can find it in our video Yeah, it was on car. Yeah, the California. So the California is a camper version of the latest van, or was. It was an all-wheel drive, so it had four-wheel drive or all-wheel drive.
There it is.
And it had basically a lot of brilliant, cool features that made it the ultimate camping. In America, it would be the Winnebago, but look at this thing. It's so cool. So obviously, it they incorporated the latest stuff that like ours doesn't have, so like that side curtain.
Well, the weird thing about the California, we didn't even get this van at all.
No, we didn't. I'm saying they never bought
it. But like even the non-camper version.
Right.
So, you know, now in theory, we have a van.
Cole, can you fast forward and showing the features? Because the features are so cool. It had like, we can't? Okay, well, then we can't show it.
Yeah.
Why can't we play it?
Copyright.
Oh.
Because this is one of our old videos, and the old videos get the copyright all confused.
Oh, okay. All right.
But there's Andre. There's really, really young Andre. This is like a 10-year-old video.
Well, thank you for letting us know. This is some weird copyright thing that YouTube's doing to us, which is hard to understand. But anyway, this is the ultimate version of the van that we bought. It has like built-in chaise lounges.
Yeah, it's really cool.
It had the pop top. It had the sunshade on the side. Nathan and Andre, young Nathan and young Andre there had a really good time. And then I went to Europe and I looked at these things because I was so impressed. And in Europe, they were like 60 to 70,000 euros. And I actually talked to Volkswagen, and I think the thinking was that it was too expensive to bring into America, that nobody would pay for it. And yet, you know, we had a storyteller, Mercedes,
I know,
that was 200,000.
So when we did the story, it was long pre-COVID. I think this was like 2018.
Yep.
But with the explosion of the vans in 2020 and 2021, this would have been such a massive seller that they really, even at $80,000, $90,000, people would have paid for this van. Because the problem was like the conversions is, so you buy like a Euro van, it's a small, easily drivable car that you can park in your driveway, park in your garage, use as a car. The problem with the Sprinter is you're driving a large, essentially commercial van that works great as a camper, but doesn't work in any other situation. So it's essentially a one-trick pony. But the great thing about the European Eurovans and then this later T5 and whatever is that you can use them as a normal car. And that was a huge thing that you can't really buy anymore. And when you add on to the fact that they were manufactured by Volkswagen or Westfalia, right? These are really reputable companies that specialize in really high quality parts and conversions. You ended up with a product that was warrantyable, very well made, very usable, and just an all round great product for daily life and camping. And that doesn't really exist anymore.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Cole's now showing all the different...
That's the UK one, the current one.
Yeah.
So it sells for £64,000, so about $70,000. Yeah, they're not cheap, but they're a lot cheaper than a Sprinter conversion, and they're a lot better made, and they're a lot more usable.
Yeah, so anyway, we bought the last T4, which is the 2003, mm-hmm. last year that they were made, and that's the one that people want because it has a VR6. They are problematic. The one we bought has 181,000 miles. They all blow through the transmissions.
Yep.
Also, the VR6 is hard to get at because it's kind of hidden underneath the
yes.
thing, and it has issues. So while we got it, and you'll see it in the series that we're producing right now, while we got it relatively cheap, and while they're valuable, we may end up putting a lot of money into it, and that's going to make, I think, the series fun to see if we can actually fix it up and then still flip it and make money.
Yeah, so be sure to stay tuned for that because I think that the van is – I'm really into it now. I wasn't that excited about it, but I think it's a really cool little van. I wish it was all-wheel drive like ours is front-wheel drive.
But they never imported the T4 all-wheel drive.
They didn't do the synchro right. But as a concept, I really think that there's still – even though I know the overlanding craze is kind of dying down and people are back to work, but the idea of just being able to take this for a weekend and then drive it to work on Monday and not have any penalty for doing either – that's pretty ace.
You know, we've got that Starlink, the little mobile one.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have to put it on the van.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Yeah, so that you have like Wi-Fi.
Exactly.
And as a little kid, I would have loved like sleeping in that pop top.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And you can see why people love them because they're so utilitarian.
Oh,
And yet they're so fun. I could see young families camping in these things. So easy to drive. It's just got everything going for it.
And ours is overall, it's held up quite well. So like the paint's okay and the interior is really nice.
It's been in Colorado most of its life, so it's not rusty.
It's a little rusty, but not as rusty as most of them because most of them rust ferociously. So check out our series coming up. I'm really excited about a Eurovan Weekender, I think is what they call them, right?
Yeah, and then we have two new cars that we got because we're going to the Easter Jeep Safari tomorrow, actually. Which if you're listening to this, it'll be last week.
And if you go to tflcar.com, Cole, I want to show off It's what we're going to check out at Easter Jeep Safari this year.
This is my favorite week of the year by far.
Scroll down. I think Zach's got the write-up. Boom! So every year, Jeep creates a series of concepts that they let us journalists drive around and kind of experience. These are the six that they've done this year. You want to see if there's any pictures that we can scroll through, Cole? So this is really cool. I think this was called the Anvil. It's a Wrangler that's got that very vintage-y reverse-facing grille on it, right, that they took off the Kaiser M715. That's a really cool-looking concept. It's got big tires. It's a V8-powered Jeep. It's got the platform on the roof. Keep going, Cole. There you go. There's the front end. So I really like the front end on this thing. It's got a really unique look.
A G-Wagon look to it.
I hope. You're right. That's true. Very G-Wagon. I hope this actually makes it into production. I don't think it will.
Like an angry G-Wagon.
It is such a cool look. Yeah. Angry G-Wagon. I like it. All right, Cole, keep going. Let's see what else we got this year. This is called the Buzz Cut. It's a two-door Wrangler that's got some really interesting top and light options on it. Keep scrolling, Cole. There's the rear view of it.
By the way, by the time you're listening to this or watching it, we would have driven them. So over at TFL Offroad or alltfl.com, if you want to see videos about all of these.
Is this not going up Monday?
Yeah, Monday, Tuesday goes up.
Yeah, so we might not have the videos up yet.
Yeah, we will, because we're driving on Monday.
That's right. So over at TFL Offroad.
Yeah, we'll get them up very quickly.
So there's the Laredo, which is kind of a vintage 70s vibe in a Wrangler. I love the mag wheels. We need more mag wheels and brown on cars. That's really cool. And then the coolest one, Cole, is the XJ. I want to kind of – there you go. So Jeep is bringing an XJ resto mod.
Because there's a new Cherokee.
Yeah, but it shares nothing in common with this XJ, so I'm not sure they're helping their case much. But fundamentally, this was a cool build. Two-door 87 XJ lift kit. Wagon wheels, custom flares, really interesting.
Yeah, and so we're going to be doing wall-to-wall coverage, Tommy, of the Easter Jeep Safari, as we usually do.
Okay.
And then next week, if you're going to come back for this podcast, actually Andre and probably a special guest are going to be kind of taking over, because Andre is at the New York Auto Show.
Yeah.
And so he's going to be doing a walk around of the New York Auto Show. So if you want to see those have become very popular. We'll have it on this channel, and we'll probably do the walk around from Easter Jeep Safari as well. So we might have two videos next week on our TFL Talk channel.
And then Cole, if you go on over to TFL Offroad, we should talk about the vehicles that we're driving out to Easter Jeep.
Yeah, thanks to Jeep, they actually sent us two really cool Jeeps. One's a Gladiator and one is a Wrangler, but they're not the stock Wrangler or Gladiator.
Yeah, they're not the normal one, because these are a special edition called the Willys 41. And what this is a throwback to the original Willys Jeep that we sent overseas in World War II. So it's got this 41 green paint, which is very similar to the olive drab that you'd see on the Willys MB and the Ford GPW. It's got these really interesting wheels, which are also olive drab, but it looks like a steel wheel, a throwback to the military Jeep. It's actually all aluminum. It's got a bunch of different looks and changes on the inside, different data plate, different shifter, and you can get this in both the Wrangler and the Gladiator. So there's our old Jeep, right? That's a 1945, but you can really see the influence that they brought into the new one.
Yeah, and we're going to be driving the Wrangler out. And then we are going to be look. How are we going to publicize? We're doing a giveaway, so our friends at Onyx have given us a golden duck, Tommy. A golden duck.
So as you know, the ducks are a big thing in the Jeep community. But this golden duck comes with an Onyx subscription.
Yeah.
So we're going to have to find.
But it's not just a year. I think it's 5 years.
Is it? Ooh.
That's why it's golden.
That's
and
great.
Not silver.
Maybe I'll keep the golden
bronze.
Duck. Am I allowed to keep the golden
no,
duck?
No, we have to give it to a fan.
We could duck ourselves.
We can't duck ourselves. So we're going to give it to somebody in Moab this coming week. And so we may post where we're going to have maybe a meetup over on our community page on TFL Offroad. No, we're not going to post
it. I don't think we're going to have time.
No, we're very busy.
We're really, really slammed. But what we will do is we will
find
the coolest Jeep and we'll give away a duck.
All right.
The only issue with the golden duck thing is that some of these Jeep guys are crouchy about the ducks.
Yeah.
So we got to find someone who will be enthusiastic.
Why are they crouchy?
The Jeep people are not into the ducks.
I thought it was all about the Jeep
people. No. Here's the thing. The fun Jeep people who just like Jeeps are into the ducks. The hardcore off-roaders that are going to Easter Jeep, not into ducks. Actually, they actively hate the ducks. It's a real thing.
Wait. So if you're a grumpy old guy and you've got a YJ,
you're gonna hate ducks.
The duck.
Yeah.
But if you're like, let's say somebody, a millennial.
Yep, who just bought their first Jeep. They're excited about it. They'll be into the ducks.
Okay, all right.
Look at who has ducks on their dash. It's normal people who are still have whimsy. All of us hardcore old Jeep people.
So no LJs.
No.
YJ. How about TJs?
No.
Are those right out too?
Yep.
How about JK? Is that on the...
No, JK people usually like ducks.
Okay, so JK or JL, but nothing older than that.
Yep. That's right, because then they're too grizzled and they don't like ducks. So we got to find – there's a lot of strategy to this duck placement thing.
Okay. So we got to look for a modern Jeep with maybe a gal driving it.
No, it could be a guy.
It could be a guy.
But you have to look for the presence of other ducks on the dash. If there's other ducks on the dash, they like ducks.
I could see why people got sick of ducks, because some people have taken it very far. Have you seen like the Jeeps with like 50 ducks on the dash? I've seen those.
Yeah, I think that's fine.
That's a lot of ducks.
Well, it doesn't impede your visibility.
It's just a lot of ducks.
Yeah, but who cares? They're fun. They're just ducks.
Well, I mean, like one duck is cool, two ducks is cool, but 50 ducks?
That means that you're a well-liked Jeep. I'll be curious to see what the IIHS crash implications of the ducks are. Like, do you think they've tested with the airbag?
Like when they have those crash tests, you think like 50 ducks go flying out of the Jeep?
Yeah, I do. I kind of want to know what happens in an accident. Are there just ducks everywhere in an accident? So... Someone look into that, please. That'd be really
interesting. Is this golden duck a bigger duck than a
regular? I don't know. I haven't seen this duck yet.
Okay. All right. Let's keep going, Tommy.
Maybe this duck will go missing in the night. And then I'll have a 5-year Onyx subscription. It's a great thing to have.
So let's talk about gas prices. So as of today, gas is almost $100, or oil is almost $100 a barrel. Average price of fuel, and this will change by the time you listen to this, unless you're listening to it live, is going to be, by the way, are there any comments, Cole?
No.
No? Oh, nobody's listening right now.
Friday morning
and nobody's around, yeah.
Oil prices, and then go to...
Oil prices are like $100 a barrel.
$98.87 right now.
Our gas prices are like, on average, like $4 a gallon, give or take.
Yeah.
So we thought it'd be fun to do a video where we do the Denver 100 and compare it an EV to a hybrid. And the results were actually pretty eye-opening. Now, this is an interesting video to do because when you... it depends on where and how you fill up your vehicle with the electric. So if you fill it up overnight at your house, it could be as cheap as 15 cents per kilowatt hour. But if you go to the supercharger, it could be, which we pay, 33 cents a kilowatt hour or a lot more depending on the time of day if there are surcharges for like it's super busy. Mm-hmm. But we filled up the new Cherokee, so we're back to Jeep, so that's the transition here.
Yep.
Hybrid, which is actually really good. It's almost 40 mpg. So we filled that up with gasoline. We didn't fill up the Tesla Model Y that we have, and we ran it for over 100 miles. And then we went and saw not how much... how many kilowatts it used or how many gallons, but how much it cost to refill. So you want to tell them what the difference was?
Well, yeah. So I think we're paying like $4.20 for the gas. And over a 100-mile loop, we spent $8.80. Nope. We spent $12 on gas.
Yep.
And then the supercharger we went to, it delivered like, I think it was 26 kilowatt hours or something. And that was $8.80. So it was about $4 less expensive on electricity.
Using public charging and public gas stations.
But if I had charged at home, that would have halved on the EV. And then I would have been looking at about $4 charging that same exact distance from my home charger. So if you're going to public stations, if you're spending 33 cents a kilowatt hour like we were, it's pretty expensive. And actually, they can get a lot more expensive. Like I've seen EAs at 50, 60, 70 cents per kilowatt hour. And then it probably would have been more to charge the EV than it would have been to fill with gas. But if you charge at home and you have cheap rates, especially that can happen at night, that's where you're going to see your money savings.
Yeah, and we did this because with gas being so expensive, we thought, people are starting to think about when their next car comes around, whether they want an EV or a hybrid or a regular car. And we were kind of curious because obviously hybrids are red hot right now. People like that transition from not full electric but partial electrification where they can still get the benefits of being able to fill up in 2 minutes at the local gas station, and then, of course, the better fuel economy of a hybrid. And so we thought, is it really better to have an EV in terms of how much money you pay now? Obviously, as they say, your results may vary, but with apparently, and I don't know where this number comes from, so take it with a grain of salt, but the number out there is that 300,000 EVs are going to come off lease this year, and everybody was expecting an EV apocalypse, right, that these things are going to go right into the trash because nobody's going to want them.
Just dump them in the ocean. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. This apocalypse. But now with fuel prices being so high, It's interesting to find out. I'm interested to see if actually this might be a good time to pick yourself up like a good daily runaround.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, this may not be your main car that you take to grandma's in Michigan, but it might be the car that you drive to work every day, especially if oil prices stay high. And the question, of course, is how long will oil prices stay high? And Cole actually brought up a good point. Last time we had an oil crisis, we were a net importer of petroleum.
Yep.
Now we're a net exporter. So why, if we actually export petroleum, are we paying $5 at the pump if you're in California, or $6 at the pump? And the problem is that oil goes into a world market, mm-hmm. and you pay basically the amount that is the international rate. And just because the oil's coming from Texas or Alaska doesn't mean that, you know, we're going to get a break on that cost. It's still going to be $98 a barrel as of today, which is probably good for a lot of oil companies and a lot of oil executives, because now they're making a boatload of money selling oil.
True.
Yeah.
Yep, true. Or maybe we'll just go out and buy Geo Metros like we did in 2008. Remember that? Where everybody was like, the Prius was still pretty new and expensive, and then everyone started like veggie converting old diesels and buying.
And so we've had this argument at the office.
Geo Metros.
Because we leased a Leaf for $9 a month, if you recall.
Yes.
In July, 2 years ago. And we only got 20,000 miles, and I think we've got like 17,000 miles on that thing. So we have another 3,000 miles to go, but we're paying insurance on it. And of course, $9 a month for the lease. So I want to dump it, but you're like, well, if fuel prices keep going up, maybe that'll be a good EV to have just as a runaround.
Yeah, for sure.
And I don't know what we should do with that thing. Let me know in the comments, what would you do if you had a Leaf at $9 a month? Now, keep in mind, we have a lot of other cars to drive, and we buy these cars and use them for content. We don't necessarily use them to commute in. And so this was a car that we bought because we wanted to create content around it. So we're kind of in a different situation than most people are. Like, we don't need a car to drive to work that's cheap. Because,
but, like, if I was in this position, if it was my car,
if it was your car, yeah.
So my Land Rover gets 14 miles to the gallon,
Your LR3.
Yeah, and at $4 per gallon, excluding maintenance and insurance, which is the same, by the way, for my stupid LR4 as it is for the Leaf.
A Leaf's like $120 a month.
Yeah, mine's $130.
Okay.
For a $4,000 car.
For insurance. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm getting scammed. But if
well, you're young.
Yeah. So I pay 28 cents per mile, thereabouts, to drive my Land Rover. The Leaf is like a quarter of that, right? It's so cheap. And the crazy thing, too, is so we're about to run out of miles on that car. 20,000 miles is at least.
We got 3,000 left.
Yeah.
In like 4 months.
But the crazy thing is, like, with this deal, Nissan has the option to extend the mileage, and it's 10 cents per mile once you go past that 20,000 miles. You can actually buy miles ahead of time, which is also an insane deal. So, like, if it was your only car, that would be.
But you're stuck driving a Leaf.
Well, it's a good car. You don't like the Leaf, but it genuinely is a really good car. It's not exciting, and it's not fast, and it doesn't go that far, and the interior is a little cheap, but it's a very comfortable, quiet, safe machine, right? So we got this email. Do you want to talk about your email you got about what it would cost to upgrade to the new Leaf?
Yeah, we got so what they do is when the Leaf, when any lease runs out, they try to basically upsell you on the next one.
Yep.
And they try to get me into a new Leaf at, I think it was $399 a month.
Yep.
Yeah, from $9 a month. And the problem with having a $9 a month lease is it's a big jump to go
from $9 $391,
$390 more a month.
Yes.
So, yeah, that upsell is not going to work. But with fuel prices continue to go up. And the question, of course, is at what point do people start making decisions based on the price of petroleum?
I think it's...
Is it when they buy a car, or is it like now because all of a sudden it's starting to really bite?
I mean, I think Americans are pretty... short-term minded in some ways. So I think that there's a higher probability of people looking to sell their cars now that gas is expensive, but it also hasn't been expensive for that long. I think it's going to take 6 months or 8 months or a full year of high gas prices before people really start changing and looking at what they drive.
The other thing that of course is a head scratcher is, you know, Ford and now Honda have all basically written down all – Honda canceled all its EV just when fuel prices are going through the roof. This, you could have foreseen this. I'm going to be a little bit boastful here, Tommy, but, you know, as long as I've been doing this, I've always said just wait a week and fuel prices are going to go back up. Apparently, The car companies didn't take that seriously.
Well, yeah, because
I've lived long enough.
6 months ago, and it took 6 months.
Yeah,
it was
not
a week.
It still happened though. I mean, I can't predict it's gonna. You know, I can't predict that in 2 weeks it's gonna go back down.
Yeah, but gas prices always go up. I mean, I could have predicted that.
And they always spike.
Yeah, but they like historically they do get more expensive. I just think that
I think they got cheap, and I think people were like, why do I want an electric car? Because you know I can fill up my Ford F-150 or my TRX, and it's not going to cost me anything. And now all of a sudden, it's starting to hurt.
I think that ultimately, long term, the hybrids are the move that they're going for. Right, Ford is going toward an old hybrid lineup. Honda's pushing hybrids and ultimately plug-in hybrids, right? So that's going to be the near-term solution to the gas prices.
Yeah, I think we got some comments.
Yeah, people want to see Karish back. We're looking at ways to bring it back.
Well, we have no gals. We want a gal in that podcast. Yep. And Jen is still on maternity leave. So as soon as we have another girl, we'll bring it back. We'll try to bring it back. The problem is, like I said, it would just be me and Tommy and Case, and we already do podcasts. So
yeah, it's got to be different.
It's got to be different, yeah.
So we're trying to figure out how to make that happen, but yeah. Yep, stay tuned for that. Anything else that you want to talk about?
I want to talk about the Range Rover that we have.
I haven't driven it enough to really know, but we have the new Range Rover Sport.
And we just got it dropped off.
Yep, which is $103,000. It's an inline six car.
Yep.
There's parts I like a lot about it from the quick drive I took. I think that the seating position and the ride quality are still some of the best in the industry. You do get that command seating position. It feels very comfy. The interior is very, very screen dependent, all screen dependent, and a lot of piano black in ours, and I think that does cheapen the experience a little bit.
The reason I want to talk about it is we're living in a time where companies that don't have off-roaders in general, mm-hmm. or serious off-roaders like Honda or Hyundai or Kia, are now building versions of their current cars that are off-roady, which I get because there's been this, I'm not saying a lot of people are going off-road, but there's been this push to build lifestyle cars that express what you want to be or what you are. And so whether you own a Passport or a Ridgeline and you ever actually take it off-road doesn't really matter. It's the fact that you drive these off-roady ones where you think that it expresses who you want to be or who you are. And I understand that completely. So companies basically that have off-roaders, don't have off-roaders or don't have serious off-roaders are now making off-roaders because that's where the market is. And yet, Tommy, companies that have a heritage of off-roaders are like not making off-roaders. And I'll give you an example of that. One of these is this Range Rover Sport, which basically on 23s and no low range, even though it has all the off-road stuff, mm-hmm. will never go off-road because those tires are like rubber bands, and God help you if you actually puncture a sidewall on a 23, which you will do very easily. And while it has all the off-road cred, it's been so street-tuned that you would never seriously think about taking it off-road. Or the recent video that we did with the new Cherokee, which is, you know, a brand steeped in as much off-roadiness as you can ever have that does not go off-road. And I don't understand that. Why are some manufacturers like tripling on off-roaders and the ones that actually have that heritage are walking away from it? It's a complete head-scratcher to me, and I don't understand.
Yeah, I agree. That's a good point.
So that's why I want to talk about the Range Rover, because it doesn't necessarily go off-road, and yet it has the technology that it should be able to. It's got air suspension, and yet if I were buying a Range Rover, one of the reasons I would buy it is because I'm not going to take it around a track. I'm going to take it, you know, to work and to school, and I want it to be able to go off-road if I have my cabin in the woods or if I want to go fishing or something, and yet with this thing, I'd be terrified.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, I mean, I think that they're looking at the data, and they're realizing that
They're not listening to their
customers. But the Range Rover buyer never takes their vehicle off-road. So why engineer a low range that weighs 300 or 400 pounds more, sacrifices fuel economy, and then takes the third owner for that person to use that transfer
case? Because they buy it because they think they will. Whether they do or not is irrelevant.
But what Land Rover and Range Rover are betting on is that they have this lineage, and that whether or not they have the actual gear, people will assume it will. And then they'll never test out to find out whether or not it will, right? That's what they're banking on. So if you're, for example, Hyundai, you don't have that pedigree, so you have to work extra hard to catch up. Land Rover does have that pedigree, and they can work less hard.
Right. Okay, so that makes sense for the Cherokee, but why not have a Cherokee now? that can go off-road, because the one that we tested...
Because, once again, they're looking really at their data, and they realize...
I think it's because Stellantis is partially owned by Peugeot, and the Europeans in general don't have a lot of off-roading. It's cultural, and so they don't understand...
Sure, I think that's part of it,
They don't understand why people in America buy... But Jeep understands it, and Jeep should be pushed back. And the guys at Jeep should be like, hey, guys, I think we need one that can actually go off-road.
Well, what they're doing, though, and maybe rightfully, maybe wrongfully, is they have that assumption that people buy Jeeps thinking they go off-road. They never take them off-road, and they would rather have 38 mpg combined, right? So that's what they're betting on, is that we think that if we looked at the data, people may buy this with that in mind, but it'll never hit the dirt, and they'd rather get 37 mpg.
There's just this constant theme that keeps coming back and back. I have never lived through a time in the auto industry, whether I was doing this as a full-time job or whether I was, you know, on the sidelines, where car companies are listening less and less to what people want.
Yeah,
I agree. Everything just keeps repeating itself. And the reason I know this is because, and I think all YouTubers, you could look at the people that we work with, or you could look at the people that also do YouTube videos. We can tell how popular a car will be by how popular that video. As much as I would love to think that people tune in because of you and me, they tune in because of the car. And I can tell just by how popular the car will be by how popular the video is. And if you read the comments, you can immediately tell what kind of the conversation is around the car.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, yeah.
And it wouldn't be that hard for a manufacturer to watch our videos and then read the conversation in the comments and realize that what people want is what people make buying decisions on, and yet they keep stuffing all this stuff into the cars that nobody asks for, nobody wants.
Definitely.
And eventually what ends up happening is you end up with, you know, Honda getting rid of all their electric cars just as people are going to start buying electric cars.
Well, that one may be less so, but I think that...
I think that's what's going to happen, Tommy.
The Cherokee is a good example of, you know, we're living in a time where, you know, people are pushing back against all this technology. I think that this would have been a good time to re-release essentially the XJ.
Yeah, right? Not a basic back-to-basics. Look, you can't do a back-to-basics car because everybody wants that, I agree. But the problem is you also want CarPlay and you also want safety, and all that stuff is very complicated and expensive to engineer. But you can release kind of a pseudo-basic car where you still have that technology that's kind of baked into it, makes it safe, makes it crashable, makes it usable in a modern way, but doesn't make it confounding from an end user point of view.
I mean, I also kind of think that we're living in a time now, especially under the current administration, where like emissions requirements have kind of gone away, and it seems like there's less focus on regulation in the auto industry. So there's less to stop a company like Jeep to release a vehicle that maybe pollutes more and is less safe, but is a lot cheaper. Right, I see this coming a lot. Why doesn't Jeep just repop the original XJ?
Well, people
probably would buy it. It would be unsafe, and it would get 8 miles to the gallon.
I think it would be an interesting topic to talk about. The other thing you can see coming a mile away, and if I can see it, they actually have futurists of these companies.
Sure, so
they know it better than I do. You can see that that this pendulum is going to go swing and swing hard the other way, because right now this administration has done away with, you know, clean air. Basically, legislation, clean water legislation, and at some point, there's a lot of people in this country who, you know, want to breathe clean air, who, you know, don't want to drive behind diesels that are rolling coal.
Sure,
and they're going to vote with that in mind, and it's going to go swinging the other way. So now you've got companies like Stellantis, you know, who have doubled down on Hemis and who are bringing all this stuff back, who are listening to them, but because of the lag time, where I was going to
go. Yeah, it does take a long time to build a car.
By the time they actually do this, Tim Kuniskis,
true.
Right?
Yep.
We're going to be living in a different era, and all of a sudden, you know, it's like Honda, they pull the plug on electric just when people start buying them, and I fear that Stellantis is going to start pumping out Hemis just when people are going to be like, no, I want a car that's fuel efficient, and I want a car that's clean. And that's going to happen. You can see that coming, because that pendulum is going to swing back the other way.
Well, guys, let us know what you think in the comments below. We'd love to hear input.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. Come back, because we are going to have a lot of off-road content next week or this week if you're listening to this. Like I say, it's my favorite week of the year. I am so excited, Tommy, to go to Moab. It's just heaven on earth.
Yep. All right, guys, we'll see you next week.
Ciao.